Rise to Rebellion, Disc 9.
The conversations were more subdued now, and even Sam seemed to understand that their energy was best saved for Philadelphia. Adams had left New York in a profound gloom, had tried to recall the cheers of the people farther north, the shower of enthusiasm they had received. New York had been very different indeed, and it was not the show of support that made the lasting impression, but the stain of politics that seemed close beneath every event. Adams stared at a slow-flowing, wide river, did not even consider the name, saw one small boat, a fisherman's, along the far bank. The New Yorkers are all so full of good cheer, all such fast talkers, boisterous, even a bit crude with their words. They all speak of this momentous event, this coming together of the colonies, but what do they truly understand? They talk of the Continental Congress as so important a milestone in our history. And yet Sam is correct. There is no talk of the Sons of Liberty. No one seems at all interested in bringing up the subject of the king or the problems we face. It could simply be politeness, not wanting to spoil their festivity on our behalf with the dirt of our crisis, but it is their crisis as well. Oh, do they not understand that? Why did they select delegates to attend this Congress? Is the business of the Congress to be nothing but a party, after all? So much social banter. How dreadful your situation in Boston must be. Please pass the wine. Are we so different? Is Massachusetts so isolated from the other colonies? The carriage struck a rock, bounced sharply. The silence was broken now, each man reacting, small chuckles. Adams glanced at the others, saw the same expression, evidence of the same mood he was feeling. Sam shook his head. "We are a pathetic lot. Are we now riding to our doomsday?" The others responded, the mood lightening. Adams thought of Abigail. "It is of benefit that my wife is not present. She has a talent for scolding me. I imagine she would find some way to look on the positive side. The people of New York, at least, seemed pleased to see us."
"It was certainly a kinder reception than the alternative," Payne replied. "We could have been ridden out of town, tarred and feathered."
Sam was laughing now.
"We haven't arrived in Philadelphia, sir. We may find that to be our fate yet."
Adams watched the fisherman again, the carriage rounding a bend, the road following the path of the river. He saw her face, began to speak to Abigail in his mind. "Yes, I do recall the reception from the townspeople, the mass of citizens. They have surprising awareness, perhaps more than all those elite who presume to control them. I would rather have enjoyed a dinner with the crowd in an alehouse, heard what they had to say about the king." He had forgotten about the small band of militia who escorted them to the banks of the Hudson, rough men who seemed ready for what? Was it all for show? Some gesture of defiance against General Gage and an army that is, after all, pretty far away? Or do they feel the threat? Understand that British troops in Boston can easily become British troops in every town? And if they are so aware of the danger, what then? Many are just like that fisherman, perhaps. Others are farmers and shopkeepers. Will they truly be pulled away from their lives, their routine, the care of their families? And can they learn to stand up to a real army? The fisherman was out of his sight now, and he saw buildings ahead, a small town spread along the banks of the river. He knew they would stop, the others now looking out, anticipating a break in the ride. He looked at the river, the name suddenly coming to him, the Delaware. This flows right into Philadelphia. Well, we are close. Tomorrow, perhaps. He saw her face again. "Yes, dearest friend, then we shall see. Then our questions, our doubts will be answered. We shall learn if those men with the guns should be so prepared after all."
Chapter 23. Adams. Philadelphia, September 1774.
The men from Massachusetts had been intercepted outside of Philadelphia, provided with wine and cautious advice from a small group of Philadelphia's own Sons of Liberty. The effects of the wine had passed quickly, but as Adams and the others had finally ridden into the city, the advice from their hosts had stayed firmly within all of them. Adams had wondered how the Massachusetts group would be received, whether being so close to the controversy ensured they would be treated as special, however the definition might apply. The Radicals and the Continental Congress surely would regard them as spokesmen for the martyrdom of Boston, treat them with humble respect, the bearers of so much sadness and sacrifice. The conservatives would react with shrill outrage, the reputation of Sam Adams irking them, their position being that the shameful energy behind the mobs of Boston would only stir up trouble and discontent. The advice from their new friends had been simple and utterly direct, to exercise discretion with their choice of words. It would benefit the Congress and anyone who leaned toward a break with England, who might be inclined to support the men from Massachusetts, if the word independence did not find its way into the official proceedings. The expectation of so many of the other delegates was that the men from Massachusetts would roll into Philadelphia with fire in their speech, inflexible proclamations, and perhaps even try to bully the rest of the Congress into the immediate acceptance of their outrage toward England. They had arrived at the Stone House, a rooming house managed under the sharp eye of a matronly woman named Mrs. Yard, already home to several of the delegates. The talk had been mostly loud, boisterous anticipation, polite greetings, some giving way to enthusiastic backslapping. Other men had stayed back, withdrawn, appraising silently, extending their hands with hesitation. Adams had not been surprised at Sam's ability to reach out, his kind and gracious words, his friendly smile for the men from every colony. While Sam had toured his way through the gathering crowd, Adams had been among the quiet ones, more interested in serious conversation. As the first evening had stretched into late hours, the delegations had begun to separate, and Adams had withdrawn to his room. He tested the bed, sat now, began pulling at the buckles on his shoes. There was a sharp knock, and Sam was in the room, closing the door firmly behind him. Adams removed one shoe, said, "Lost? Well, no, at least you knocked." Sam ignored him, was pacing, bursting with energy, finally stopped, faced him. "John, this is... I never expected... We are in for a real time here."
"Do you mean that as positive?"
"Oh, my, yes, indeed. It's the right strategy, you know. Keep quiet on the issues. Don't burst out with all our demands. They quite expect that from us, but they are surprised, don't know what to think, find that we are actually civilized. I hear the men from Virginia are quite behind us, can do quite a bit of talking on our behalf. This fellow, Henry, Patrick Henry, could easily mistake him for a Bostoner. And did you meet that fellow Richard Henry Lee, another friend for certain?"
Sam seemed lost in thought, and Adams said, "You can't remember them all on the first night, Sam."
Sam looked at him, didn't seem to understand, and Adams thought, "Well, no, he certainly can." "What of the New Yorkers, Sam? And some of the Pennsylvania men? I met this fellow Dickinson. Seems friendly, but I understand he is quite the conservative." Sam frowned. "Yes, Dickinson. Flies in the ointment, those fellows. We shall see how this divides out, how many of them are of a mind to agree with us."
"It surely is not a competition, Sam."
"It surely is, John. In the end, it may come down to a simple vote. Who can gain the most support? We cannot expect everyone to immediately come together and pour out a resolve, some document defining our plan of action."
Adams pulled at his other shoe. "Well, yes, Sam, I understand that, of course. But we must hear every view. We must know how each colony perceives their role in this, how each colony interprets the rule of law."
"Yes, yes, John, you do exactly that. You speak about law. I understand what I must do here. I must remain discreet. I must speak quietly, without bluster. If I cannot convince men like Dickinson, then I must simply find allies to outnumber him. I must win them over one at a time, work in the shadows, influence from behind, not from in front. It is not my place to be an orator here, John. I leave that to you."
He paused, his thoughts turning in his mind.
"Did you know
There's no one here from Georgia?
Yes, I was told.
They didn't send any delegates. Not sure that's a problem, though. Mostly cotton farmers. They probably feel more than a passing affection for the British fleet. Too much wilderness down there. They'd rather have British soldiers in their towns than Indians.
Their absence is unfortunate. They should be represented here.
Sam ignored him, moved to the door, lost again in thought. He stopped, looked at Adams. This your room?
Adams smiled, glanced around. I believe so, yes.
Sam seemed to ponder this. Yes, good. Get some sleep.
We begin tomorrow.
Sam was out the door now, shut it hard behind him. Adams sat back on the bed, leaned against the wall. He was exhausted, all the days of travel rolling over him. But Sam's energy was still infecting him, and he tried to see the faces, remember the names. So many just like us. So many not like us at all. But we are here. We are together. And we shall learn a great deal tomorrow.
September 6th, 1774. The rumor had begun, as most begin, panic at the sight of troops, the expectation that bloodshed must surely follow, must surely be the only possible result. The troops were marching to Charlestown, the village north of Boston, just across the mouth of the Charles River. The local militia there had become too bold for the comfort of the British command, had accumulated a store of gunpowder and two cannon positioned where the local citizens convinced themselves they could be put to good use. More than one man had bragged indiscreetly about the town's arsenal, and more than one Tory had brought the news to General Gage. When his troops marched out of Boston, the countryside had surged to life, word spreading that the British had begun what so many had feared, a rampage of fire and death. When Gage's troops simply confiscated the powder and guns, the rumors grew bolder, fueled by embarrassment and anger at the loose talk of those who could not keep the existence of the munitions quiet. The rumors fed the fears of the people, and word spread quickly that the troops had actually fired on citizens, laid a path of widespread destruction, fire and chaos. Across the countryside, the farmers and militia began to assemble, muskets held high at the sudden call to bloody revenge. Nearly 20,000 men had gathered around the limits of Boston, surprising the British who had already concluded the simple job of hauling and floating the munitions out to Castle William. As the truth about the British raid filtered through the region, passions subsided and the great mass of armed men reluctantly dispersed, returning to their farms, speaking in angry rumblings of what might have been. But word had traveled far, and before anyone had realized the power of the false rumor, the men assembled in Philadelphia received only the most extreme version that Boston smoldered in ruins, blood in the streets. Before the great orations, before the fiery debate over the most incendiary issues of the day, the Continental Congress had first to absorb the horror that the rumors brought, that the worst fears of even the most devout Tories had come true. They would convene in Carpenter's Hall, the home to the city's Carpenters Guild. The sight was an unmistakably stern message to the Conservatives, who had favored another venue, something with more of an air of government. But the hall conveyed to any observer that many in this strange mix of delegates were far more interested in communicating an allegiance to the interests of the common people. As a compromise to the Conservatives, the Congress had elected Peyton Randolph as its first president. Randolph was an aristocratic Virginian, and the most conservative member of that delegation. While the presidency was a parliamentary position and carried no real authority, the move was an appeasement to some who feared the radicals would make an immediate attempt to take over the business of the Congress. The rumors of the alleged catastrophe in Boston had come early, and the four men from Massachusetts had withdrawn from the opening of the Congress, had requested a few minutes to meet quietly among themselves. The room was small, attached to one side of the larger chamber. Adams stood close to Cushing, waited in black silence for Sam to join them. No one spoke. And Adams glanced at Payne, who leaned against a small table, staring glumly at the floor. Adams looked out toward the open door, could see the solemn, concerned faces in the larger chamber. Then he noticed motion, heads turning, and he saw Sam moving through the larger crowd, then into the smaller room. He was trembling, his hands curled into tight fists, his breaths in sharp, tight bursts. "The only word I can get is that the warships suddenly lined up along the wharf and began to bombard the town. We are hoping to receive more details from some of the merchant ships coming down from Providence. More riders are expected as well." Cushing was near tears.
"I cannot understand it. Is there no decency? Are they not civilized?"
Adams could feel waves of sickness, his gut twisting in cold knots, the vivid picture of a burning city lodged in his mind. Across the small room, Payne said, "We must know more. What happened? What prompted this?" Sam seemed about to burst, prowled around the small room. "I am not sure I believe it." Payne seemed to come to life.
"What? Why?"
Sam fixed his gaze on Adams now. "You should appreciate this, John. Proof. Evidence. Mr. Payne asks the correct question. What prompted this? There is no protest in Boston. Most of the citizens have gone. Why should the British destroy the city? Gage has control, has all the power. There is no one to oppose him. If he destroys the town, where will his soldiers sleep?" Adams felt a spark, a piece of light cutting through his mind. "Yes, surely, Sam. It is so fantastic. It cannot be true. Not all of it. We must wait to hear from the ships. They will know more. They deal with the farmers, the merchants. There has to be some explanation." Cushing rubbed his face with both hands. "I hope to God your optimism is warranted, gentlemen. We have families to consider. I will not rest until I hear something." It had been Adams' first concern, and he reassured himself again. "They are all back at Braintree. Surely there was no reason for them to be in Boston."
"I agree, Thomas," Payne said. "Sam, we must consider the reports to carry at least some truth, and that means we have something important that we must confront right here. What will this news do to those men out there?"
Sam raised one clenched fist in front of him, regarded it.
"We will find out what kind of fortitude this Congress has. We will learn if we are so alone after all. They're waiting for us."
Sam moved to the door, and Adams followed, heard a hum of voices in the larger room. Shortly the chamber fell silent, and Adams moved to one side, saw Randolph standing at a rostrum and saying, "There is no one man in this room who does not share the apprehension and the feeling of outrage that have befallen the gentleman from Massachusetts. I was not prepared for this. I would appreciate a suggestion on how we should proceed." Cushing raised a hand, said in a soft voice, "May I request a prayer, gentlemen? Mr. Randolph, if you will consider it acceptable, perhaps some devotional text to begin these proceedings." Adams saw several hands go up. Randolph acknowledged one. "Mr. Jay of New York."
"I deeply respect the feelings of the gentleman from Massachusetts. However, how can we observe any moment of devotion that would be fitting to us all? This gathering is ripe with Presbyterians, Anabaptists, Episcopalians, Quakers, Congregationalists, and I have doubtless overlooked a few."
Randolph pointed again, said,
"Mr. Rutledge of South Carolina."
"I agree with the gentleman from New York. We must not offend anyone's prejudice here, not so early in these proceedings."
Sam stepped forward, close to Randolph, spoke up.
"If I may politely suggest, sir, I am no bigot, and I will gladly hear a prayer from any gentleman of piety and virtue who is at the same time a friend to his country. As you know, I am a stranger to Philadelphia. However, I have heard of a clergyman here whose character is well known. I believe his name is Mr. Duché. Might I move that this gentleman be allowed to read a prayer to this meeting?"
There were nods, calls of approval, and Adams stared at Sam, had never heard the tone of his voice so intensely calm, so ingratiating. The motion was passed, and Adams caught Sam's eye, a quick nod. "Well done, Sam. Despite what may have happened in Boston, here,
We are gentlemen still.
Contend, O Lord, with those who contend with me. Fight against those who fight against me. Take hold of my shield and buckler, and rise for my help. Draw the spear and javelin against my pursuers.
The man was gray-haired, bent with age, but read the 35th psalm with a clear voice to the bowed heads of the assembly. When the reading was concluded, Adams looked at the faces, saw many of them looking downward still, quiet reflection. Then slowly the gazes lifted, and he saw the eyes focusing on Sam, then him. Gradually there was motion, one man first, the sharp energy of the Virginian, Patrick Henry, who came straight toward him, held out a hand, said with urgency,
"God bless you, sir. If there is a fight, then we will fight together."
Henry angled toward Sam, said something Adams could not hear, the sharp voice muffled by the sounds of others who moved close to him, more hands, words of blessing and encouragement. Adams took the hands, wanted to respond, some bit of eloquence, but there was emotion rising in him, choking away the words. Men introduced themselves to him, so many names, and he nodded silently, tried to smile, felt the hands on his shoulders, heard the words, some soft and reassuring, others, like Henry's, already surging into anger, the anger that would carry forward into the great debates. The reports finally came southward, reliable now from men who had been in the town, who had seen Gage's troops. The rumors of Boston's destruction were completely false. While Adams felt a great release of fear and anxiety, the mood in the Congress was subdued. For that one awful moment, the debates had been silenced, and though no one believed it would remain this way, they had put aside the animosities, rivalries, disagreements over politics and philosophy. They had reacted to the rumors as one body, one people. The fictional destruction of Boston had created an awareness in every delegate in the Congress that the same reports could suddenly come to them from Charleston or Norfolk. They felt the same devastating fear, soothed now into a growing conviction that no colony, no matter how distinct, should have to submit to any such outrage alone.
Chapter 24. Adams. Philadelphia, October 1st, 1774. The passions and camaraderie that had been ignited by the rumors of Boston's destruction had faded, each man now settling into one of the opposing camps, some exercising their skills as speakers, others simply lining up with the viewpoint that made them the most comfortable. As the discussions had droned into long-winded debate, leaders had emerged, some by the strength of their orations, some by their ideas alone. The conservatives had begun to coalesce around the Pennsylvanians John Dickinson and Joseph Galloway. Galloway had drawn up a plan that suggested a renewed effort at direct negotiation with the British government, a pact pledging to secure the joint cooperation of the colonies in a calm discussion of any grievance or controversy with the mother country. Galloway proposed a grand council, a national legislature representing all the colonies, which would serve as a subservient and miniature version of the British Parliament, subject to veto by the king. Galloway's plan had drawn surprising support, and Adams had been distressed at the conservative mood of the Congress. He had begun to feel a deep frustration that all that was happening in Boston was being forgotten, that the immediacy of the crisis was being replaced by the dull winds of politics. He still did not know how long the Congress would continue to meet, knew that the harvest was coming soon and that there was almost no chance that he would be home in time to tend to the farm. As his frustration increased, so had the length and frequency of his letters to Abigail, pouring out to her what he could not say out loud in the Congress. But through it all, the discouragement came most from realizing that so many delegates seemed content with the terms of Galloway's proposal. As the more outspoken delegates found their resolve to break with England blunted by the conservatives, Adams began to fear that this Congress would only conclude with a wordy resolution not to anger the king with any more talk of independence. The dinner was at the home of Pennsylvania's Chief Justice Chu, who spared no detail in providing for the honored guests. When the call came for dinner, Adams was stunned by the display, a vast table spread with every kind of meat and bread, bowls of fruit, jellies and sweets. At one end of the table was a cluster of bottles, tall and thin, short and squat, wines, ports and Madeira. He had almost become used to this kind of excess, knew that many of the delegates took full advantage of the hospitality of Pennsylvania's aristocratic hosts. As he moved along the table, sampling from the many dishes, Sam's words echoed in his mind, "Feasts," and he backed away, made room for the others moving in behind him. "So, Sam, are we to feel guilty about this? Is it improper, after all?" The question answered itself, and he stared at the table again, his appetite slipping away. It was the fourth meal of this much grandeur this week, and while the men in front of him grunted and hummed their appreciation, he moved toward a chair at a small table to one side.
"Wine, Mr. Adams?"
The voice was unmistakable, and Adams smiled up at the Virginian, Richard Henry Lee. "Thank you, yes, I seem to have forgotten." Lee produced two glasses, poured them full, placed one beside Adams' plate, seemed to hesitate, and Adams said, "Would you please join me, sir?" Lee sat, placed the bottle between them. "Your cousin not joining us this evening?" Adams shook his head. "He would rather work than eat."
"Yes, so I have learned. Energetic man, your cousin, passionate in what he believes."
Adams felt uncomfortable eating while Lee merely watched him. He leaned back in the chair, put his fork down, looked across at Lee, and Lee raised his wine glass, took a slow drink. Lee was a few years older than Adams, from one of the most aristocratic families in the colony of Virginia. Adams had learned that Lee and Patrick Henry were the two most able orators in the Congress, and both men were strong supporters of a complete break with England. Lee put the wine glass down.
"Forgive me. We should have had a toast. Salute our cause."
"Sam believes our cause may be in some difficulty." Lee laughed.
"You mean our friend, Mr. Galloway?"
"His plan seems to have a lot of sentiment behind it." Lee sniffed.
"Sentiment? But there is no power to the idea. Some of these fellows are very nervous about what we are doing in Philadelphia. Galloway offers an easy solution, and so the first inclination of the uncertain is to accept that which seems easy. You know it will not work. Worse, it is utterly ridiculous to believe that after all this time, after all that the King has proscribed for Boston, that he would welcome some negotiation. Mr. Galloway believes we are still in some sort of partnership with England. He is wrong. And even the most timid who claim support for his plan know he is wrong. The plan will not prevail in this Congress."
Adams was impressed with Lee's calm certainty, said, "I wonder about what the people will accept. Those of us from Massachusetts are prone to see things from a point of view of a people who have endured a great deal at the hands of the British. Most people in the other colonies do not have such experience. Mr. Caswell told me that in North Carolina there are entire communities who welcome the hand of King George in their every affair." Lee sipped his wine again, then added,
"Mr. Chase says the same of Maryland. I'm certain there are many people beyond these walls who regard all of our doings here as dangerous talk."
Adams stabbed at a piece of meat on his plate.
"I wonder how Sam will tolerate this. He's used to getting his way, to running the show. I'm not sure he has patience for so many different points of view."
"Your cousin has his place here. He is the plough by which we all reap the harvest. I grow tobacco, Mr. Adams. I understand you do a bit of farming yourself."
Adams nodded. "On a small scale, but yes. I enjoy the land as much as I enjoy the practice of law."
"Which makes you the perfect man for this job. You and I have that in common, a skill in the law, a love of this land. Both are necessary to understand why our fight is so important, why it must succeed, and it will succeed. Perhaps not this year, perhaps not this Congress. But we have taken the first step. We have broken ground."
Adams did not share Lee's optimism.
Do you believe we will have to do this again? Another Congress? Can we not complete the task before us? What task is that, Mr. Adams? Convince the Conservatives here to allow us to break away from England, establish the independence of the colonies, create our own government? I admire ambition, Mr. Adams, but Rome was not constructed in a day. Adams had not considered there might be more than one Congress. He was impressed with Lee, thought of Abigail now, her lecture on the bits of genius. I am certainly facing one now. He attacked the food on his plate, his appetite returning. These men are so divided, so many of them reluctant to embrace any notion of change, I must frankly admit to becoming annoyed by the long-winded speeches, by the oratory of so many men who seem to demonstrate only that they enjoy the resonance of their own voice. What began a month ago with such enthusiasm has settled into a tedious contest of endurance. Lee chuckled again. Discouraged, Mr. Adams? I am surprised. I try not to be, but every deliberation is so spun out, and there is so much wit and eloquence, so much demonstration of learning and acuteness. I cannot help wondering if a resolution was to be offered that 3 and 2 equal 5, we would be entertained with logic and rhetoric, law, history, politics, and mathematics, before 2 days later passing the resolution in the affirmative. Lee sipped from his wine glass, pointed a finger at Adams. You may be right. And that is why some good is destined to come from this Congress after all. So many of these gentlemen agree with your impatience. It is easy to overlook that not every man here is so impressed with his own talents. For every man like Galloway or Dickinson or Jay, there is a man like Colonel Washington. The name was only vaguely familiar, and Adams said, I don't know much about him. Hasn't said much, doesn't breathe fire, but he's here because he cares deeply for what happens to Virginia, to all of us. He's paying attention to all of it, I assure you. Those are the men we must depend on. We must offer them an alternative to Mr. Galloway's simplistic solution. We require some infusion of passion, Mr. Adams. Something even the Conservatives cannot debate. The day's debates had stretched late into the afternoon. More of the same, the Conservatives pushing for a vote on Galloway's plan. Voices had begun to speak out for holding off, delaying the final decision, and the words had grown hotter, each round of discussion increasing in volume with the weariness of the speakers. They did not notice the man at first, the clothes ragged and dusty, moving into the gallery with hesitation, seeking out some familiar face. He had ridden hard, made the trip down from Boston as quickly as any man could ride, brought the precious piece of paper to the delegates who would need to know. Sam had spotted him first, a quick, solemn greeting, the two men slipping quietly to the smaller meeting room. Adams had seen them, followed, and now there was curiosity, questions from the other delegates. Adams saw Sam looking back toward him, saw Payne and Cushing gathering as well. He moved past the tall man, Colonel Washington, moved close to Lee, who said, "Should we know who that gentleman is, Mr. Adams?" "His name is Paul Revere. He is from Boston. Something rather important, it seems. A moment, please." Adams was free of the questions now, moved into the room where Sam was saying, "Let's see it, Paul." Revere smiled through the grime and exhaustion of the long ride, slapped the paper against his thigh, a small cloud of dust. He handed it to Sam. "Not sure if this will mean anything, but the Assembly voted unanimously that you should be made aware of this with all speed." Sam read the paper, broke into a grin, nodded. "Dr. Warren has been busy." Revere continued. "Gentlemen, I have reports as well on the British activity. It seems General Gage is fortifying Boston Neck. It is quite likely that during the time it has taken me to reach Philadelphia, Boston may have been closed to any traffic." Cushing took the paper from Sam, read as Payne spoke. "Gage's plan hasn't worked. Boston is not simply accepting her punishment." Adams reached for the paper now, said to Revere, "Suffolk resolves. Why Suffolk?" "They convened the Assembly there as a protest to Gage's authority. I can only tell you that patience has run out.
Dr. Warren asked me to inform you that the reasonable citizens of Massachusetts realize there is no cure for what the British are trying to do, unless the chains are quite simply thrown off. It is hoped that by your communicating the Suffolk resolves to the Congress, it may help us in finding some sympathy from the other colonies.
Sam took the paper again, held it up in front of him.
They declare that King George has violated the English Constitution by the unlawful suspension of rights.
He read for a few seconds more, then summarized. A call for a refusal to pay taxes to any representative of the Crown. The Port Bill is considered null and void. Disregard the authority of British soldiers. Take hostages, if necessary, to free anyone arrested on political grounds.
Sam looked up with a broad smile. I must agree, Paul. Dr. Warren is correct. This is just what this Congress needs to hear.
October 28, 1774. Many of the delegates had already left Philadelphia, and if some felt the Congress had failed in its mission, many more understood that it had been an extraordinary 2 months. Galloway's plan had been defeated, and in the end, the delegates had approved a Continental Association, a specific list of non-importation and non-consumption policies to be observed throughout the colonies. The Congress understood that, ultimately, they could not effectively strike back at the King's policies except by the muscle of economics, that the only real punishment the colonies could inflict was on the pocketbooks of British merchants. If there was to be a war, the Congress would not support aggression. It voted to support Massachusetts by military action only if the British were the first to open hostilities.
Adams had gathered his clothes, scanned the room for anything he had missed. In the hallway he could hear goodbyes, earnest salutes, respectful tidings among men who might not ever meet again. He heard one voice, sharp, distinct, went to the doorway, saw Patrick Henry speaking to a small gathering. Henry saw him, said something to the group, wended his way toward the open door. Adams backed away, but Henry stopped at the doorway. "Mr. Adams, I had hoped to speak to you, might I?"
Adams waved him inside, pointed to the one small chair, but Henry said,
"No, I will stand. It's your room."
Henry glanced at the leather bag on the bed.
"You are leaving soon, then?"
"Yes. Sam might stay for another day, but we will be returning to Boston." Henry rubbed his chin, seemed to be putting his words together.
"I truly hope your family stays out of danger. You as well. No one knows what you may find there."
There was a soft sincerity in Henry's concern, and Adams responded, "Thank you. We will do what we must. It seems the decisions are made by those who do not have much concern for the consequences."
"Do you think there will be any improvement in affairs? Did we accomplish anything at all?"
Adams was surprised at this question coming from the man who had led so much of the discussion, the man with the sharp words for every debate. "We won't know that for a while. But if the British do not back away, if the King insists on strengthening his grip on the people, I am deeply afraid that there is only one appropriate response. We must fight."
Henry nodded. "By God, Mr. Adams, I am of your opinion. I believe the next gale from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms."
Adams could hear enthusiasm in Henry's words, but he did not share the man's energy. "I hope to God you are mistaken, sir. I so hope I can return to a quiet home. It is all any of us asks for." He closed the bag now, tightened the wide strap. He did not know what else to say, could still feel Henry's desire to talk. There was a silent moment, and then Henry went on.
"Whatever the result, this Congress was momentous. The talk is pretty clear that we will convene again. I hope you will include yourself in the proceedings, sir."
"Perhaps. That decision will be made by others. My wife, for one. This is difficult for her. She has become quite the farmer." He smiled. "Farmeress." Henry backed toward the doorway.
"Please convey my respects to your Mrs. Adams, and, sir, my deepest respects to you as well."
Henry moved away, and Adams could see Abigail in his mind now, imagined her in the house, surrounded by the children, writing her precious letters, "Dearest friend."
Yes. Home again. Not so many stops this time. There is no need to tour the countryside. Our job here is done. He had a sudden spark in his mind. Thought, the date. Today, the 28th. October 28th. He lowered his head, let out a long breath. 3 days passed, and it never entered my mind. He picked up the bag, slung the strap over his shoulder. I am sorry, dearest Portia. 10 years. Our 10th wedding anniversary. And I quite forgot.
Chapter 25. Franklin. London, October 1774. He had stayed out of the public eye, heard enough to stay clear of the intense hostility toward him in the ministry. But to many he was still a symbol, if an unofficial one, and to those in the government who still could not quite fathom what was happening in the colonies, Ben Franklin was here now, and would usually oblige their questions with a pithy answer about all the things gone wrong with the empire. Strawn was the one friend with tight connections to the king's cabinet who would still risk a visit, not afraid to be seen by the gossiping neighbors. They had finished a long evening meal, left the fireplace to Mrs. Stevenson, climbed the stairs to Franklin's room. His knees had been bothering him, the long walks less frequent now, and he stood at the top of the stairs, a tight frown on his face. He looked away from Strawn, but his friend had already seen his expression.
"Something wrong, Ben. You're hurting."
"We're all hurting," Franklin replied. "Nothing healthy about anything these days." He moved slowly into the room, eased into his chair, Strawn following, sitting across from him. Franklin picked up a letter. As Strawn watched him, he observed, "Hiding behind your papers won't work, my friend. I know you too well." Franklin pretended to read, still, his watery eyes blinking, the lines of black ink blending together into an unreadable blur. He had not wanted company. Learned only when Strawn arrived for supper that he had been invited by Mrs. Stevenson, her quiet way of trying to lift Franklin from his awful mood. His attitude had grown more sour throughout the meal, and now he felt himself sinking to the bottom of some great black sea. Resigned to the inevitable conversation, he put the paper down and said, "Are we all in a state of decay? Are the infirmities of old age so infectious that not only the bodies of the people, their very bones, but everything they touch, everything around them, every institution must collapse into something rotten?
Old age? Is that what has you so bound up in misery? Forgive me, Ben, but you've endured old age for a good bit longer than many. It makes no sense to start worrying about it now."
Franklin did not smile at Strawn's joke, shook his head.
"No, it's not just growing old. My legs hurt. My knees are giving me some difficulty on the stairs. But I'm not in such bad condition. Better off than my son, certainly. At least my brain is functioning clearly."
Strawn smiled.
"Have you heard from William, then?"
Franklin gave the Englishman a hard stare.
"You should know very well how often I hear from my son. He writes to you more than anyone else. You have his ear now, his loyalty, you and your king. I hear from him when he lectures me about coming home. I hear from him when his finances require my assistance. He writes to me in these patronizing tones about how dangerous it is for one of my political persuasion to be roaming loose in London as though I am some rabid beast."
Strawn looked down.
"He feels he can confide in me, Ben. It's no secret. William is a fine governor, a man true to his loyalties. He serves his king well. He is aware that his father does not approve."
Franklin sniffed. "He's not wrong about that." He paused, shifted position in the chair. "When I lost my position as postmaster, I warned him to be careful, that he could easily become a target as well. Probably was already the subject of talk in the ministry. I suggested, subtly, that he consider resigning. He did not take the advice."
Once I understood that he intended to keep his post, I thought, all right, then make your stand. But protect yourself, because there will be suspicions. It seems I worry too much. My son is perfectly capable of wrapping himself securely in the king's robes. Ben, there is no fault in an officer of the crown maintaining his loyalty. The duties of a royal governor are difficult in the best of times. These are not the best of times. He dares to offer me advice, Will. He preaches to me about my political indiscretions. He criticizes my writings. Tells me not to inflame the passions that are already inflamed. Is that the official philosophy, the royal solution to our problems? Keep quiet and let things just happen? He was angry now, the dark mood rolling into fury. He felt his hands shaking, looked at them with tired eyes. I am not accustomed to becoming this upset. My whole being is affected. There was a silent moment. Have you heard from Deborah? You know very well I have not. It's been too long. She's probably angry again. I've grown used to it. William wrote me that she has not been well. They all just want you to come home. She is busy with our affairs. The printing business is taking her every moment. Our son-in-law, Mr. Bache, is doing what he can, but she is always in command. By Christmas, the holidays, it will slow down. She will write then. He did not like thinking about her when the letters did not come, could not help worrying. When he did not hear from her, he would write more often, trying to inspire a response. For several months, he had hinted to Mrs. Stevenson that perhaps a gift was needed. And occasionally a package would come in return. But even then, the letters had been brief, a curt acknowledgement, rarely anything else at all. I had thought I would go home this fall, November perhaps, but I must wait now. The Continental Congress will certainly issue some final document. If they petition the King or Parliament, it will be my job to communicate that. Strawn stood now, and Franklin knew he had stepped onto uncomfortable ground. Strawn moved to the window, stared into darkness, mused. It is all so misguided. What would they have the king do? They destroy the tea, they spit in the face of authority. How can an entire people spit in the face of authority? Are not the people ultimately the authority themselves? Strawn turned, smiled. Ben, not this again. You know very well that if they had just offered to pay for the tea, none of this would be happening. Franklin was taken aback by the smugness, the simple answer to all the problems of the colonies. I will not debate you, Will. Neither you nor my son nor King George himself. Like a poor card player, you have shown your hand to the people. If you do not enjoy hearing protest, if you are made uncomfortable over some disagreement with your policies, you may depend on your king, who has no hesitation to take away everything of value. You have your army, your navy, your power. The message you have given the colonies is clear. They have nothing that is not granted at your whim. By assaulting Boston with such a clumsy sword, you have united your opposition. Don't you understand that? Don't you understand what the Continental Congress truly represents? Strawn shook his head, the smile not changing. Ben, the king must maintain a firm hand. I'm sure your Congress will spout some formal document, yet another petition to the king to loosen his hold, change his mind about the punishment he has enacted in Boston. And what should he do then? Kneel down to this Congress and say, thank you for enlightening me. I made a mistake. I will manage the empire by your rules. Franklin moved the stack of papers beside him, searching, found the article he sought, held it up. Strawn stepped forward, read the title, Rules by which a great empire may be reduced to a small one. Yes, I recall, Ben, a brilliant exhibit of sarcasm. You sent quite a few shudders through the ministry with that one. Franklin looked at it, opened the first page, went on. I had hoped someone there would see beyond the sarcasm. This was very popular, you know. Even the English people understand folly. He read aloud.
never believe that the discontents of the colonies are in any way justified. Listen to all the governors say, and to nothing from the friends of the people. Invest the general of your army in the provinces with great and unconstitutional powers, and free him from the control of your civil governors.
Yes, yes, Ben, I printed some of these, remember? Admirable work, if a bit lengthy.
Franklin put the papers down. As I recall, you sold quite a few as well. More of this has actually come to pass than I ever expected. Some would suggest that the king misread the title and used this as a guidepost to his policies. Strawn sniffed, and Franklin could see he was impatient, eyeing the door. All right, Will, you've accomplished your mission. As you can see, despite the fretting of Mrs. Stevenson, I am not close to my deathbed. Sadly, I can't say the same for your empire. Strawn ignored him, moved toward the door, stopped.
Any other visitors lately? Anyone I should tell the ministry about? Some seditious plotting, perhaps?
It had been their usual joke for a while now, but Strawn was not laughing. The routine, tired, worn. Let me think. Actually, last week I saw a gentleman from the countryside, name of Thomas Paine. Desires to make a new start in America. I gave him a letter of introduction, told him to see my son-in-law in Philadelphia. He has an interest in writing, he says, probably on shipboard already, conjuring up new offences to the king. Slipped through your steely grasp. Franklin tried to laugh, but Strawn was weighing his words, so he added, "Oh, really, Will, Mr. Paine is no threat. An unemployed bureaucrat with illusions of finding a voice among the oppressed."
Strawn still did not smile. Opened the door. "Thank you for the visit, Ben. Take care of those old legs."
He was gone now. And Franklin stood, closed the door, shuffled slowly toward the window, feeling the stiffness in his knees. He stared out into the darkness, could see motion in the dull lamplight, Strawn's carriage moving away.
"It is all so different now," he thought. "Everything has changed. My wife has stopped writing me. My son has become a thorough courtier, a hollow mouthpiece for the king. I can't even entertain my friends. They've lost their sense of humor, or worse, their sense of history. Just like their country, an empire who hides behind its army to justify its own mistakes. A deadly sign, to be sure."
December, 1774. The house was empty. Mrs. Stevenson at the vegetable market. Franklin was tending to his mail, sat at the small desk in his room. He opened the envelope, saw an unfamiliar gold crest, thought another bit of wisdom, advice, or criticism, perhaps, brought forward on the gilded wings of someone's precious family title. He was surprised to see the letter was brief, an honest inquiry into the colonial mind. My word, they actually want insight. A plaintive cry for solutions. Unscramble the eggs for them. He scanned for the name. Unfamiliar. Viscount Gradington. Not a government minister, just some bored aristocrat who doesn't understand what the fuss is about. He read the final line of the letter, a gracious invitation to explain what exactly might satisfy the Americans, avert the messiness of conflict. Well, at least he's inclined against a war. He set the letter aside, moved a paper on the desk, something he had been working on. This should do nicely as a response, he thought. Just complete the message. He took his pen, held it over the paper, said aloud, "All it requires is a few R's." He wrote now. "Recall your forces. Restore Castle William. Repair the damage done to Boston. Repeal your unconstitutional acts. Renounce your pretension to taxes. Refund the duties you have extorted." He stopped, thought. Require payment for the destroyed tea? Perhaps. Am I as naive as Strawn, as the rest of them, to believe it may yet hinge on that? Would that be all it took to rejoice in a happy reconciliation?
He was annoyed now, put the note aside. They expect me to provide the answers. One old man with sore knees. What qualifications do I possess that makes everyone around here care so awfully much what I think? There was a sound from below, a bell at the front door. Now a man called out, "Hello, Dr. Franklin?" He rose, went to the window, opened it, felt the sudden chill, leaned out, saw the man standing at the door below, huddled against the sharp wind. "Yes, up here." The man looked up, a short wave, said, "Dr. John Fothergill, sir, may I intrude? Only a moment." Franklin backed inside, closed the window. He hurried downstairs, limping slightly, the one knee still aching. "I sent for no doctor. Perhaps Mrs. Stevenson is caring for me behind my back." He opened the front door. "My apologies, doctor. Mrs. Stevenson is out. Sorry to keep you in the cold." Fothergill moved to the hearth, the dull embers of a dying fire. Franklin hurried to one side, grabbed a short iron rod, began to stir the ashes. "Sorry again, I neglected to feed the fire."
"Please, Dr. Franklin, no trouble on my account. I just came by to ask if you would be interested in a game of chess."
Franklin set the rod down, blinked at Fothergill. "Excuse me, did you say chess?"
"Quite, sir. I come with an invitation for your consideration. I was asked to convey this to you by a friend. Well, it's somewhat convoluted. Are you acquainted with Lady Howe?"
"No, not really. I believe
"She is the sister of the two esteemed military commanders, Lord Admiral Richard Howe and General William Howe. It has been requested of me that I offer you the opportunity of an evening of chess with Lady Howe."
"Lady Howe wishes to play chess with me? Why?"
Fothergill seemed exasperated. "Please, doctor, there are great machinations at work here. I come only as a messenger. The lady made quite the point, was in fact most insistent that I communicate to you that your company is highly prized. Will you accept?"
"How can I refuse? You have my curiosity leaping great walls, doctor."
Fothergill seemed relieved as he headed to the door. "A carriage will call for you tomorrow afternoon, 3 o'clock, if that is acceptable."
"Fine. 3. Are you leaving already?"
Fothergill was already moving into the cold. "Yes, sorry. Good evening, sir." Franklin stared at the closing door, felt the chill filling the room again.
"I have not played chess in a while now. I must think about what this woman may expect. Is this simply a social call? Does she believe she can best me? Certainly she didn't invite me just to lose a chess game. Great machinations, indeed."
He waited in the drawing room, the servant gone now. He scanned the portraits, the glassware decorating the shelves which lined an entire wall. He moved closer, leaned low, studied the ornate writing on one porcelain vase, Chinese, certainly. He eyed the artifacts displayed all along the shelves. Suddenly he realized these are constructed as bookshelves. But there are no books, none. He looked all around the room. The fellow did say this was the drawing room, not one piece of paper to be found. Not much drawing going on in here. At one end of the room a chess set had been arranged, and he moved close, saw ornate pieces in rich ivory, one set of crusading warriors pearly white, the other with lacquered appointments, military insignia on each piece. The board itself was an inlaid pattern of blue lapis, alternating with mother of pearl. He wanted to examine the pieces more closely, reached out, hesitated, thought, not a chess set one would find in a Chelsea market. Perhaps this one is for show. Maybe they actually play with something more durable, a bit more utilitarian, perhaps, like carved wood. I'd be more inclined to handle something a bit less expensive.
Please don't be shy, doctor. It was my grandfather's favorite set.
He turned to see the doorway filled with a luscious gathering of rich, deep red. The dress made a silky whisper as she swept into the room, a soft air of graceful delicacy. She was tall,
held herself straight, the hair and jewelry perfect, a soft fragrance of something floral now blossoming in the room. He stared for a long moment, reflected, "She is amazingly beautiful." Then he remembered the rules, made a sudden low bow. "Lady Howe, I presume. Your invitation honors me. I was not aware that chess was enjoyed by members of such an esteemed family. That you would accept the challenge of one so unworthy to grace these halls." His mouth was pouring words like a spilling pitcher, and he stopped. Suddenly felt ridiculous. Had rarely lost his composure like this. He was still bent low, thought, "Well, stand up for God's sake. You're not a butler." He rose, saw a hand in front of her face, a spray of lace at her wrist. He heard the sound now, soft giggles. He wanted to say something else, told himself, "Don't appear to be such a clown." She made a small curtsy now, an unusual gesture toward a commoner.
"I would hope you could be comfortable here, Dr. Franklin. Please, I would rather save the formalities of the royal court for the royal court. Would you care for some tea? Brandy? Cognac?"
"Whatever your ladyship wishes, I will be pleased to oblige."
"What I wish is to converse with you over a game of chess, Doctor. May I hope for a long visit? I do hope my invitation has not interfered in your important business."
"No, not at all, Lady Howe. I am completely at your ladyship's disposal." He was still nervous, felt annoyed with himself, tried to avert his eyes as she swept toward the chess table. The red silk passed close to him, and he could not escape the generous display of ivory skin beneath her delicate necklace. She gave him a quick smile as she stood beside the table. He waited for whatever was next, realized suddenly she was waiting for him. He rushed forward, slid the chair out from the table. "Oh, forgive me, Lady Howe." She let out a small, tinkly laugh.
"Please, Dr. Franklin, do relax. It will make this day much more pleasant if you accept that you are welcome here as my honored guest. This is rather a special privilege for me, not a formal occasion. Please do sit down."
He moved to the other side of the table, enveloped by the scent of flowers, sat slowly, felt his mind suddenly go blank. He examined the chessboard, reached for the tallest piece, the king, cradled it gently in his hand, marveled at the detail, the fine workmanship of some long-dead craftsman. There was a long silence, and he wanted to speak, say something profound, provide some display of knowledge about ivory carvings.
"You do know how to play chess, Doctor?"
Her voice brought him back to the moment, and he put the piece down, tried to steady his hand. "Oh, my, yes, your ladyship. I was admiring the set. Extraordinary."
"You are white, Doctor."
He put a hand to his forehead, said, "I'm sorry, please forgive me, I just need a moment."
"Doctor, the chess pieces, you are white. I believe that means you may move first."
He felt a rush of blood to his face, thought, "Well, you are not white now. Get hold of yourself, man. She expects you to play chess, not fall about her like some schoolboy. You're old enough to be her much older father." He reached for a pawn. "Yes, well, I shall begin here." She responded to his move, and he moved again, another pawn. She leaned over slightly, and he felt the soft wisp of the floral scent. He blinked, tried to focus only on the board, watched her fingers slowly wrap around a knight. Small hesitation, then she moved the piece forward, an aggressive tactic.
"You do not play defensively, Lady Howe."
"I prefer the assault, Doctor."
He moved again, immediately realized he had made an amateurish mistake, and she removed his pawn from the board.
"Was that carelessness, Doctor? I do hope you're not allowing me some advantage. I assure you I do not require it."
"Oh, no, Lady Howe, I would not be so insulting. I will pay closer attention."
He scolded himself.
"Do not allow her to distract you. There is, after all, some honor at stake here."
As he was pondering his next move, she said,
"So what do you suppose is to be done with this
dispute between Great Britain and the colonies?" He looked up at her, saw her studying the board. She went on, "I do hope we are not to have a civil war." She moved her knight a second time, again an aggressive move, and he tried once more to focus on the board. "I would suppose, your ladyship, that they should kiss and make up. Quarrelling can be of service to neither, but is ruin to both." He moved a pawn again, an attempt to threaten her knight, and she reached out, swept the pawn away, another victim of carelessness. He frowned at his mistake, stared hard at the board. "I have often said that I wish government would employ the services of one such as you to settle this dispute. I am sure no one could do it as well," she said. He tried to concentrate.
"I thank your ladyship for the good opinion of me, but the ministers would never think of employing me in that sort of good work. They choose rather to abuse me. It's something of a sport these days."
She sat back, looked at him. "They have behaved shamefully toward you, and indeed some of them are now ashamed of it themselves. I know of one in particular who wishes to make your better acquaintance. Are you familiar with Lord Admiral Howe?"
The game had disappeared from his mind now, and he saw her looking at him with a blank innocence, a total lack of guile. "Very good," he thought. "Now we have come to the real game, the real reason I am here. She is quite the manipulator. The Admiral cannot meet with me himself on any official basis, so this will be an accidental meeting, a chance encounter over a game of chess. Well, all right. Surely, Lady Howe, you don't mean that Lord Howe is here?"
"Quite so, Doctor. If you will allow, I should be pleased to send for him."
"By all means, your ladyship."
She gave a quick wave of her hand, and he saw motion by the drawing-room door, had not noticed the servant who stood just beyond. He saw she was attending to the board again, seemed suddenly to concentrate exclusively on the game. He smiled, shook his head, thought, "Why not just drop the pretense? Is there really a chess game now?" "Forgive me, Doctor, but there, I believe this move would be checkmate."
"I assure you, Dr. Franklin, no one understands the problems we face with the clarity that you bring to every subject." Franklin was still examining the details of Howe's uniform, the rich colors, lace, and silk. "Your lordship flatters me."
"Nonsense, sir, it is plain truth. The ministry knows full well that you are the one man who can bring some sense to this ridiculous dilemma. It is ironic, of course, that those who speak so highly of you behind lock and key are the same men who have treated you with such violent disrespect."
"Excuse me, my lord, but no injury done to me compares with the injuries done to my country. I cannot consider my private affairs to be of any consequence when the affairs of the public are so grave."
"Your humbleness is well known, Doctor. In fact, there are many among the ministers who wish to open some communication with you. Since you are naturally assumed to find some discomfort with that, I am offering you my services."
Franklin sipped from the small crystal wine glass, studied the matter-of-fact confidence of Admiral Howe's expression. He set the glass down.
"Forgive me, your lordship, but in what way could your lordship be of service to me?"
"I propose to speak on your behalf to whomever you desire to reach. With complete discretion, of course. No one need learn about any conversation we may have."
"With all respect, your lordship, it has been my experience that three men may keep a secret only after two of them are dead."
Howe seemed set back by his words.
Yes, quite so. However, neither of us is dead, and I assure you, no secret, given my trust, will escape."
"Forgive me, your lordship, I intended no insult, but please understand my lack of respect for official secrecy. My personal mail has become common reading material at the ministry. Any conversation I have with even a casual friend is reported to someone in authority, and I am fairly certain my every move is watched by more than a passing glance. I must question why any of those gentlemen whose decisions are supported fully by the king would possibly care what advice I might suggest."
Howe studied his wine glass, slowly finished the contents, set the glass aside. He reached into his pocket, produced a tightly folded mass of paper, offered it to Franklin.
I don't imagine you have yet seen this. Franklin unfolded the thick paper, saw now the heading. Petition of the Continental Congress to His Majesty King George III, the Continental Association. Franklin sat up straight, a sudden burst of excitement. My lord, did this just arrive? Howe laughed. It is one of the privileges afforded those who hold the position of admiral. My statement was rhetorical, Doctor. I am quite certain you have not yet seen your Congress's petition. You may have that copy for yourself. It was addressed, in fact, to you. Franklin twisted in the chair, scanned the words quickly. So even the Admiralty intercepts my mail. I must know what this says, but not now. This is not the time or place, but I must know. Doctor, my invitation remains open. I would suggest you prepare for the Ministry a list of those conditions that you see as important to solving the current crisis. This is a unique opportunity, Doctor. You have an illustrious reputation in the arts and sciences. You may find this to be the opportunity to add to your formidable credentials a sterling reputation as a statesman. You may also discover the rewards that may shower upon a dutiful servant of his country. Franklin dissected Howe's speech, one word lodging in his mind, rewards. Surely he cannot mean a bribe. Forgive me, your lordship, but I believe this document will contain exactly what you are requesting of me. That was, after all, the purpose of the Continental Congress. Howe sniffed, let out a small laugh. Really now, Doctor, do you honestly expect that any document emerging from that spurious gathering of radicals will contain solutions? They have the nerve to issue a petition directly to the King. I can assure you that it is the view of most of the ministers, and I might add of the King himself, that the colonies are already in a state of rebellion. No government can be expected to give serious attention to demands made from such an outrageous assembly of criminals. Franklin stared at the papers in his hand, a dark cold spreading in his chest, his mind swimming with words. He tried to clear his thoughts, saw Howe now refilling his wineglass, said slowly, "But this represents..." "I assure you, Doctor, what that document represents will be given little attention here. We are much more eager to know your thoughts, your plan for resolving this crisis. Dare I say again, sir, your very future could be secured by your willingness to serve your king and country. You are not so influenced by the criminal element in Boston." Franklin stood slowly. "Please, your lordship, express my pleasure to Lady Howe for her hospitality. I will consider your lordship's suggestion. Certainly any rational possibility of defusing this crisis must be entertained, no matter the source." His carriage was waiting for him at the front entrance of the grand house, and he made his way slowly down the flat steps, climbed up into the carriage, rubbed the soreness in his knee. The wine had filled him with a strange, uncomfortable heat, and as the carriage lurched forward, he sat back in the cushioned seat, rubbed a slow twisting in his stomach. He felt the papers in his pocket, the surging curiosity to learn the details dulled by a wave of depression. "What does it matter?" he wondered. "If Lord Howe is so casual with his disregard of the Congress, then the same will come from the others, even the King. They might actually believe that I will somehow devise something that will miraculously end all of this, but surely, surely they must understand what this document means for me." He thought of Howe's words, "criminal element." "Describe the Congress as you will, sir. But if they are criminals, then you may as well arrest me now."
This ends Disc 9.